the tears, old man, on your face and your hands are shaking. Is it fear, old man, or just a trace of hatred awakening? You're sorry to tell and tell. This is the world, oh man, for which you were in love. A cultured pearl, oh man, that your heart and hand look sad.
General Sherman cut out the back of Atlanta with 68,000 hard-worn Yankees. He drove them down through Georgia to the sea. With hate in their hearts, they moved in a line, cutting a scar through God's blessed country, 50 miles wide. Burning, looting, gutting our land like vultures. They tore up the railroad tracks. They burnt the cotton and the gin. Lord, they made everybody suffer.
Terrible Tommy here in California, and it is the December 19th, 2017, and this is Tears Day. Yeah, Tears Day all day today, and it's nice and warm out here. I don't know where you're at, but we're doing pretty good. I haven't checked today, but I think it's about 80 degrees out there. About ready to put my thong on and go out there on the beach. Okay, boys and girls, I got a surprise for you today. Maybe not a surprise to all of you, but I'm going to read from a book here. A thin book, actually. It's only about 100 pages. And we'll see whether you can guess who wrote it, because it's one of the most radical anti-Jew books that I've come across over the years. Now, I'm not going to give you the title, because then you'll probably know, some of you will. It was written quite a while back. Here we go. The Jewish Question. German Jews Seek Emancipation. What kind of emancipation? Civil and political emancipation. Bruno Bauer answers them as follows. No one in Germany is politically emancipated. We non-Jews are unfree. How can we free you? You Jews are being egotists when you demand special emancipation as Jews. You should rather be working as Germans for the political emancipation of Germany and as men for the emancipation of mankind. You should learn to regard the peculiar form of your oppression not as an exception to, but as a confirmation of the rule. Or do Jews simply demand equality with Christian subjects of the state? In that case, they recognize the Christian state as the legitimate one and recognize that it is a regime of universal subjugation. Why do they object to their particular yoke while accepting the universal yoke? Why should Germans become interested in the liberation of Jews when Jews are not interested in the liberation of Germans? The Christian state knows only privileges. In that state, the Jew has the privileges of being a Jew. As a Jew, he has rights that Christians do not have. Why then does he want rights he does not have, but which Christians do? When the Jew demands emancipation from the Christian state, he asks the Christian state to give up its religious prejudice. Does he, the Jew, give up his religious prejudice? What right, therefore, has he to demand of others the abdication of their religion? The Christian state cannot, by its very nature, emancipate the Jew. But Bauer adds, the Jew cannot by his very nature be emancipated. As long as the state remains Christian and the Jew Jewish, the one is as incapable of granting emancipation as the other is of receiving it. The Christian state can behave towards the Jew only in a manner of a Christian state, that is, in a privileged, conferring manner. It permits the separation of the Jew from its other subjects, but makes him feel the pressure of the groups from which it has separated him. All the more acutely in that he represents religious opposition to the ruling religion. But the Jew in turn can behave towards the state only in a Jewish manner, that is, as a stranger. He opposes to real nationality his chimerical nationality, to real law his illusory laws. He feels that his separation from the rest of mankind is justified. He does not participate in the movement of history as a matter of principle. He waits for a future that has nothing in common with the general future of man. He regards himself as a member of the Jewish people, and the Jewish people is for him the chosen people. On what grounds, therefore, do Jews demand emancipation? On the grounds of your religion? It is the deadly enemy of the state religion. As citizens of the state, there exists no true citizens in Germany as human beings. You are not more human than those to whom you appeal. After criticizing the existing positions and solutions proposed to them, Bauer considers the Jewish question from a single angle. What is the nature, he asks, of the Jew who seeks emancipation and of the state which is to emancipate him? He answers with a criticism of the Jewish faith, analyzing the religious opposition between Judaism and Christianity, and elucidating the character of the Christian state. He does this with boldness, acuteness, spirit, and thoroughness in language that is precise, vigorous, and meaningful. How does Bauer solve the Jewish question? His formulation of the question itself contains his solution. An analysis of the Jewish question provides the answer to it. His analysis can be summarized as follows. We must emancipate ourselves before we can emancipate others. The stiffest form of opposition between the Jew and the Christian is religious. How is it to be resolved? By making it impossible. How can this be achieved? By abolishing religion. As soon as the Jew and the Christian recognize their prospective religions as different stages in the evolution of the human spirit, as successive snakeskins shed by history, man being the snake that bore them all, they will no longer stand in a religious relationship to each other, but in a critical, scientific, and human relationship. Science is their ground of unity, and contradiction in science are resolved by science itself. The German Jew, in particular, is faced with a lack of political emancipation in the state that is avowedly Christian. But Bauer holds that the Jewish question has universal significance, independent of the specific German situation. It is for him a question of the relation between church and state and of the contradiction between religious ties and political freedom. Emancipation from religion is presented as a condition both to the Jew, who is to be emancipated politically, and to the state, which is to emancipate him as well as itself. Very well, one says, and the Jew himself says it. Quote, the Jew is to be emancipated not as a Jew, not because he possesses such broad ethical principles. He is rather to fall in line with other citizens and become one of them in spirit of being a Jew and wanting to remain one. That means he is and remains a Jew in spite of his being a citizen living in a typical human circumstance. His limited character as a Jew always wins in the end, even over his human and political obligations. The prejudice remains even though it is overtaken by general principles. But if it remains, then it takes over everything else. Quote, the Jew can remain a Jew in political life only sophisticatedly, only in appearance. If he wants to remain a Jew, this appearance becomes reality and triumphs. This means that his life in a state is only an appearance of an exception to the reality of the rule, unquote. Let us see how Bauer views the duty of the state. Quote, France, he says, has recently offered us, with regard to the Jewish question and with regard to all other political questions, the spectacle of a life which is free, but which revokes its freedom by law. That is, it proclaims freedom a mere appearance and contradicts free law by deeds. Quote, universal freedom is not yet law in France, nor is the Jewish question solved there, because the legal freedom, which makes all citizens equal, is limited in actual life, which is still ruled and divided by religious privilege. This lack of freedom in real life turns on the law and forces it to divide citizens in themselves free into oppressors and oppressed. When will the Jewish question be solved in France? Quote, the Jew would cease being a Jew if he stopped letting his law prevent him fulfilling his duties towards the state and his fellow citizens. For instance, if he went to the Chamber of Deputies on the Sabbath and took part in the public debates. All religious privileges, including monopoly of a privileged church, would have to be abolished. And if a man or some men, or the overwhelming majority of men, still believed it necessary to fulfill religious duties, such fulfillment would be left purely as a private matter. Quote, religion no longer exists when there is no privileged religion. Take from religion its exclusive power and it ceases to exist, just as M. Martin du Nord felt that the proposal not to mention Sunday in the law was a proposal to declare Christianity no longer existed. It may be assumed that with equal justice and a declaration that Sabbath law is no longer binding on Jews would amount to a proclamation that Judaism had been dissolved. Thus, Bauer asks, on the one hand, that the Jew give up Judaism, and man generally give up religion, in order to achieve political emancipation. On the other hand, he holds that the political abolition of religion means that the abolition of religion as such, a state which assumes religion is not yet a true, real state. The religious concept does, indeed, offer guarantees to the state, but to which state? To what kind of state? It is here that Bauer's one-sided representation of the Jewish question becomes apparent. It is by no means enough to investigate the question, who is to emancipate and who is to be emancipated. Still a third kind of question must be subjected to analysis. What kind of emancipation is at stake? What conditions are assumed by the kind of emancipation demanded? See what religion does to people, drives people insane. Only analysis of political emancipation itself provides an ultimate analysis of the Jewish question and its inclusion in the universal questions of our time. Since Bauer does not raise the question to this level, he falls into contradictions. He presents conditions that are not based on the true nature of political emancipation. He raises questions which are not pertinent to this problem and solves problems that leave questions unanswered. Bauer says that the enemies of Jewish emancipation, that their mistake lie in assuming the Christian state to be the only true one, and failing to subject it to some same criticism as the Jews. We hold that Bauer's error consists of subjecting only the Christian state to criticism, rather than the state as such, and in failing to investigate the relation of political emancipation to the larger emancipation of mankind, so that he presents conditions that can only be explained by an uncritical confusion between political emancipation and human emancipation in general. Bauer asked the Jews, have you, from your own point of view, the right to demand emancipation? We, on the contrary, ask, has the champion of political emancipation the right to demand of the Jews the abolition of Judaism and of mankind the abolition of religion? The Jewish question receives a different formulation depending on the country in which the Jew finds himself. In Germany, there is no political state as such. The Jewish question is a purely theological one. The Jew finds himself in religious opposition to a state which believes that Christianity is its basis. This state is a theologian ex professo. Criticism here in two folds of both Christian and Jewish theology. And so we are still operating, however critically, in the sphere of theology. In France, a constitutional state, the Jewish question is a constitutional one, a question of incompleteness of political emancipation, since France maintains the appearance of a state religion, even though by the empty and self-contradictory formula of the religion of the majority. The relation of the Jew to the state still remains the appearance of a religious and theological opposition. It is only in the free states of North America, or at least in some of them, that the Jewish question loses its theological character and becomes a truly secular one. Only where the political state exists in completely realized form can the relation of the Jew and of the religious man generally to the state appear in all its purity and peculiarity. Analysis of this relationship ceases to be theological as soon as the state ceases to stand in a theological relation to religion and replaces that relationship with a political one. Criticism then becomes a criticism of the political state. It is a point where the question ceases to be theological that Bauer's critique ceases to be critical. There exists in the United States no state religion, nor any religion proclaiming to be that of the majority or preeminence of one religion over another. The state is foreign to all religions. Indeed, there are some American states where the Constitution does not impose religious belief and the practice of religion as a condition of political rights. All the same, nonetheless, America is particularly the land of religiosity, as Beaumont, Tocqueville, and the Englishman Hamilton unanimously agree. But American states serve only as an example. The question is, what is the relation of full political emancipation to religion? If we find even in the land of full political emancipation that religion not only exists but blossoms fresh and strong, we have proof that the existence of religion is not opposed to the full development of the state. But since the existence of religion is an existence of a defect, the source of this defect can be sought only in the nature of the state. We hold that the religion is no longer the operating cause, but the result of human limitation. We therefore derive the religious small-mindedness of free citizens from their general small-mindedness. We do not maintain that they must abolish their religious limitations in order to abolish their human limitations. We do not turn secular human problems into religious ones. We turn religious questions into secular ones. History has been too long been dissolved into superstitions. We now dissolve superstitions into history. The question of the relationship of political emancipation to religion becomes, for us, a question of the relationship of political emancipation to human emancipation. We criticize the religious weakness of the political state by criticizing rather its defective worldly constitution. We resolve the contradiction between the state and a particular religion, such as Judaism, into a contradiction between the state and certain secular elements, religion in general, and the state's own assumptions. the political emancipation of the Jew, the Christian, or the religious man in general is a question of the emancipation of the state of Judaism, Christianity, and religion in general. The state emancipates itself from religion, both as to form and content, by emancipating itself from any state religion, that is, by professing no religion except its own statehood. Political emancipation from religion is not emancipation from religion carried out without opposition, because political emancipation is not human emancipation carried out without opposition. I think I may stop there for today. Gets a little dry. You may be shocked when I tell you the author of this. I've only read you about 10 pages. I'll get into it again. But I think you can see, because this was written back in the 1800s, 19th century, how disastrous religion has been to the human race. No matter what race you are, religion has been a disaster. And in many of the wars, just under the surface lurks the cult of religion, in our case, Christianity. For in our situation, our example was that simply economics could not have started the Civil War. While it is true that most wars have a lot of greed and finance and the underpinnings, but in reality, like the Civil War, they were agitated by people like John Brown and all those anti-slavers, that if they hadn't been around, there wouldn't have been a war. So you got to understand that. People say, oh, religion doesn't cause war. Geez, look at the Middle East. Religion doesn't cause war. No, the underpinnings of war are greed. But the agitators are religious fanatics. The very basis of Israel in the Middle East is testimony to how fanatical it is, claiming that some spook in the sky gave them a country. Well, that's pretty cool, you know. I know other people have done that too, but not like the Jews. We're chosen people, and God gave us this land, which is total, unadulterated bullshit. And all of this nonsense that goes on today hovers around that concept, which is totally, absolute, a lie and false, and actually caused the Jews tremendous anguish themselves, and will continue to do that as long as this religious fanaticism is maintained. The only way I can confront people like this without blowing my stack is when I go to a department store to buy a package. I say, I'm a non-believer, but I hope you have a nice holiday. That's as close as I can come to civility with religious people.
Let's consider an argument that even non-believers present for the existence of Jesus. It seems pretty reasonable to argue that if you are fabricating a story, you don't go out of your way to invent aspects of that story that seem forced and artificial. Why make life difficult for yourself? Let's take an actual example, that extraordinary tale of a worldwide census requiring Joseph to take his heavily pregnant virgin bride all the way to his ancestral hometown of Bethlehem, where of course she gives birth to Jesus, and thus fulfills an ancient prophecy. This yarn from the Gospel of Luke is so full of improbable, wrong, and frankly ludicrous elements that even many Christians recognize that the story is simply a charming fable. But now, here comes the crucial point. It has been expressed, in fact, by none other than the late, great Christopher Hitchens in his magnificent God Is Not Great. Hitchens, no friend of religion, was trying to be fair-minded to the Christian case and says this: "The best argument I know for the highly questionable existence of Jesus is why go to a huge amount of fabrication concerning Augustus, Herod, Quirinius, and a census to move the scene to Bethlehem. A much easier fabrication would have had him born in Bethlehem in the first place." In other words, here is inverse proof that someone significant was born in Nazareth, and Luke's contortions became necessary to momentarily shift the action into the place where everybody knew the Messiah had to be born. Does this argument hold water? In reality, it's simply a variation on the embarrassing errors argument. But in this case, we have not an error, but a supposed fact. Where it goes wrong is in assuming that, more or less, someone at some stage, later identified as Luke, sat down and wrote a story, weaving some facts he was compelled to use with fictional elements of his own. But he didn't. Luke had before him at least two earlier versions of Jesus' tale, and in the two we know of, Mark and Matthew, the parents of Jesus do not inconveniently live in Nazareth. Mark has nothing at all to say about the birth of Jesus, nothing about Joseph, and nothing about Bethlehem. And in fact, if we recognise that the intrusion of Nazareth in the opening baptism scene of Mark's Gospel is a later harmonising interpolation, we see that elsewhere, in the original Greek manuscripts of Mark, the writer never says Jesus is from Nazareth either, but only ever refers to Jesus as a Nazarene. From his first miracle at Capernaum through to the last words of the angel in the tomb, Mark speaks of Jesus the Nazarene. The word most probably means branch or offshoot from Judaism, an appropriate label for a hero with a new message from God. Now, the nativity was added to the basic Markan story by the author of Matthew late in the day, when the original end of the world had passed. And Matthew does place the Holy Family conveniently in Bethlehem, not inconveniently in Nazareth. Matthew's Jesus is born in a house, not a stable, and he lands up in Nazareth only later in order to fulfill a prophecy. Now, Luke tidied up a lot of Matthew's handiwork. He knew that Matthew's claim that the prophets had said the Messiah should be a Nazarene had no support, so Luke dropped any reference to such a prophecy. Luke retained the notion, popularized by Matthew's gospel, that the boy Jesus had grown up in the otherwise unknown Galilean city of Nazareth. But that meant he had to find a pretext for briefly moving the action to Bethlehem, and here a census referred to in the histories of Josephus worked much more convincingly than Matthew's vague Nazarene prophecy. Luke also dropped the unconvincing references to a massacre of infants, a flight to Egypt, and instead substituted an orderly blessing in Jerusalem from an elderly prophet who greets the child as a light to the Gentiles. He then completes his story with a return home to Nazareth. All very sweet, all very familiar, and all very bogus.
Let's take a closer look at that Nazareth bit. We all know, I think, that there is a major city of Nazareth in Israel today. It has a largely Arab population, but it plays a major part in Israel's tourist industry. Over 1 million visitors, many believing Christians, pass through Nazareth every year and no doubt are confirmed in their faith. We can trace the history of Nazareth back through many centuries, in fact, as far as the 4th century, when the mother of Emperor Constantine, Helena, made a pilgrimage to the so-called Holy Land. She was in particular concerned to find relics and sites associated with her newly acquired lord. Now, in fact, At the place where Nazareth now stands, Helena found no city, no town, not even a village. Nothing, in fact, apart from a well, said to be, by quick-thinking locals, the well from which Mary, the mother of Jesus, drew water. About that well, the empress ordered the construction of a church. A generation later, another touring grand dame associated with the imperial court, Egeria from Spain, visited the same area. She found, or rather was directed towards, a cave, and this was said to be the very cave where the Holy Family had lived. Again, a church was built over that spot. From this construction of two churches, a holy settlement was established. Soon it became a place of pilgrimage and drew in a population to service and profit from the flow of pilgrims. So from the 4th century onward, we certainly have a town of Nazareth. Rather more pertinent to the study of Jesus, however, is the situation before the 4th century, that is, from before the official endorsement of Christianity as the approved faith of the empire. Now, it is a fact that in the 3rd century, the church father Origen, who lived, incidentally, in the coastal city of Caesarea, barely 30 miles from where Nazareth now stands, made the comment that he had no idea where Nazareth was located. We also had the testimony of the so-called Pilgrim of Bordeaux, an early visitor to the Holy Land who has left his itinerary for posterity. And interestingly enough, although this pilgrim visits and records so many places referred to in the Old Testament, he makes no reference at all to the city or town of Nazareth. Searching through other early sources, an interesting picture emerges. Nazareth is mentioned not once in the entire Old Testament, nor is Nazareth mentioned in the holy works of the Jews, the Talmud. The letters ascribed to the Apostle St. Paul, though mentioning the name Jesus more than 200 times, not once mention the town of Nazareth. In fact, no ancient history or geographer mentioned such a place. As it happens, 200 years of searching by biblical archaeologists gives no support to the town existing in the first century either. There are meagre finds from both earlier and later periods, most of them associated with burials. But at best, the few artifacts point towards a small farming settlement, perhaps a single, or perhaps two or three extended families, but nothing that would correspond to the so-called city of Nazareth recorded in the Gospels. Now, such a tiny, rustic community would not have had a synagogue where Jesus might have spoken. Now, how can it be that neither archaeology nor historical sources support the claims of a city of Nazareth as found in the Gospels? The answer is that the city of Nazareth is a product of religious faith, not its precursor, as the hometown of Jesus. In the original fable, written in Greek by the author, which we now call Mark, we don't find Jesus of Nazareth, but in fact, Jesus the Nazarene. Nazarene is quite unrelated to a place name. It refers problematically either to truth or to branch, and may possibly have some link to Nazarite, one who takes a religious vow. Now, the later version of Mark's tale that we call the Gospel of Matthew substituted the town of Nazareth for Nazarene in order to give his hero a hometown. The name Jesus of Nazareth is fabricated and misleading. With the city referred to in Holy Scripture, the state-sponsored religion of the 4th century set about creating a city to fit the fable. In 1st century Galilee, there was no Nazareth. And if there was no Nazareth, there was no Jesus of Nazareth. Here's a lie invented by the church. Consider a very important figure in the fable of Jesus, one who has had her own very illustrious career. I mean, of course, Mary, the mother of Jesus. the Blessed Virgin. Quite a superstar in her own right. Now the truth is, and anyone can check this, the scriptures have very little to say about the supposed mother of the supposed Jesus. Let's take a look at the first of the Gospels. The first to be written, that is, the Gospel of Mark. In Mark's Gospel, there is no divinely sponsored pregnancy, no pageant at Bethlehem performed by shepherds and wise men, no reference at all to Jesus' ancestry. The tale begins with a report about John the Baptist and features the baptism of Jesus as an adult. His family are nowhere in evidence when Jesus is tempted by Satan in the wilderness, or calls his disciples, performs his first exorcisms and healings, and starts preaching. In fact, the first reference to family isn't until chapter 3, when we're told that they think him mad. Well, he has, after all, started up his own cult and enraged the local Pharisees. When his unnamed mother and his brothers turn up to claim him, he rejects them, and like many a cult leader, tells his followers they are his family. Later, he raises the ante on that and says that each of his followers will get mothers and fathers a hundredfold. Mary, his purported mother, is referred to only once by name in Mark's Gospel, when the astonished locals in Nazareth can't believe his wisdom and identify him as a carpenter, the son of Mary. That is the only reference to her by name, and as far as Mark is concerned, Mary has no important role in the drama of Jesus at all. Matthew says a little bit more about Mary than does Mark. He introduces a prologue to his gospel that was unknown to Mark, the pretty nativity tale that entertains children. Now Mary acquires a quality here that would have astonished the mother of several children that we read about in Mark's tale, virginity. She also acquires gold and precious gifts after the birth of her child from adoring wise men. And she is also fortunate to be having a husband who has very helpful dreams and communications from angels. It leads them to traipse first into Egypt and back again to Nazareth. Now what makes it all the more surprising is that when Matthew gets to Mark's bit about the family thinking Jesus mad and coming to collect him, he leaves the whole narrative more or less word for word in place. But you would think with gifts from visiting wise men and prophetic warnings from angels in dreams, let alone the mass murder of infants supposedly by Herod, that Mary and Joseph by this stage would have realized their son was a tad special. Now Luke has his own ideas about how to develop Mark's simple tale. For Mary, he introduces her to her first lines of dialogue, chatting with an angel and proclaiming how thrilled she is by the whole experience of birthing the Saviour of the world. But after returning to Nazareth with the baby, Mary, the mother of Jesus, is heard of no more in Luke's Gospel. And John's Gospel has precious little to say about Mary at all, although he does contribute two famous episodes, the one with Mary attending at the wedding in Cana and has Mary standing at the cross for the grand finale. What is remarkable is not Mary's simple life as portrayed in the Gospels, but the extravagant development of that life in later centuries. Mary's own biography blossomed over the centuries, with early Christian writers like Justin elevating her as a second Eve, whose obedience reversed the sin of the original garden dweller. Artemis, the goddess of Ephesus, and Isis, the goddess of from Egypt, became the templates for this new super Mary. As a result, Mary became a perpetual virgin, and Jesus' brothers and sisters had to become his cousins. A second century fiction named Mary's parents and gave her an early career in the Jewish temple. In the 5th century, the church decided that Mary was not merely the mother of Jesus, but the mother of God, and thus she acquired the character of the Queen of Heaven. Mary's success is really quite extraordinary, with numerous saints' days, a chapel in every church in Christendom, and a worldwide following. Even today, Mary puts in an appearance everywhere that Catholicism launches a major marketing campaign. But it isn't truth, it isn't fact, it's just more astounding rubbish. Between a history embroidered with propaganda, such as we find, for example, in Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars, and a fantasy placed into a historical setting. Such an example would be Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. The Jesus Tale is very much in the latter category, a fictional drama in which a stereotypic hero has been intruded into a more or less realistic historical landscape. As we would expect from a fictional creation, there exists not a single contemporary reference to such a character, not a single genuine artifact, nothing to substantiate that he ever walked the earth. The traditional authorized version of Christian origins is a Big Bang theory. It suggests that one fine day, the only begotten son of God materialized in a virgin's womb. He grew to manhood, assembled his disciples, imparted his wisdom, died, and rose again. From this, a religion was born. How far should the rational thinker buy into this story? The idea of Jesus convinces many that someone must lie beneath the encrusted legends. Many, of course, reduce the Christian superstar to a dimly perceived good man, who perhaps said some wise words, fell foul of Roman and Jewish authorities, and managed to get himself crucified. The Big Bang theory now boils down to little more than Christianity exists, it must have begun somewhere, it began with a single character, here's my version of who he really was. And favourites include an itinerant philosopher, or a religious reformer, a pacifist like Gandhi, or a militant like Che Guevara. In fact, Jesus has been reformed 100 times. One thing of which historians and New Testament scholars are well aware is the trajectory by which the Jesus tale developed from an original text. Matthew, Luke, and even the fourth gospel build on a brief original tale without miracles and post-death appearances written at an uncertain date by an anonymous author. Church tradition alone identifies this as Mark. Matthew took the story off in one direction, and he packed the text with prophecy. Luke, in contrast, trawled through the works of Josephus for tidbits of historical accuracy. Whatever else, eyewitness testimonies they are not, and the story was all but unknown until the second half of the second century. Aware of these difficulties, New Testament scholars suggest a number of traditions preceded the gospel tales. And what do these earlier traditions tell us of Jesus? The Essenes anticipated Christianity in a number of respects, as did the Therapeutes of Egypt, held by the church historian Eusebius as early Christian monks, yet they were established well before the Christian era. What then are we to make of the thinly drawn life of Jesus? It certainly appears to owe an extraordinary amount to Jewish scripture, whether drawn from Adam, Moses, Enoch, Melchizedek, Elijah, Elisha, etc. And it's a vast anticipation of the words and deeds of Jesus. Christian apologetics uses the words fulfillment, but a simple word copying explains the same. What are we to make of the multitude of parallels to Jesus' law to be found in ancient world mythology? Even the embarrassed church fathers spoke of diabolical mimicry. It seems that Satan himself clearly understood the true message of the Jewish prophets and was thus able to preempt Christianity centuries before the arrival of Jesus by copycat gods. In fact, we have absolutely no trace or mention of Jesus' exploits anywhere until the Gospels were written decades after the purported events. Desperate to penetrate this fog, some scholars strive to identify an early layer of teaching,
said to derive from an historical Jesus. But does a saying's tradition really point to a single author of wise words? The Bible itself provides an answer. We have a saying's collection in the book of Proverbs, which is attributed to Solomon, but it was standard practice in the ancient world to lend authority and prestige to new material by falsely accrediting a prestigious figure from the past. But even more fatal to the claim of a saying's tradition is the patent failure of anyone to record any of the supposed astounding new teachings at the time. If a great multitude throughout Syria, Galilee and the Judea heard and believed, how odd that no one recorded those sparkling gems of wisdom. The truth is that Christianity grew from neither a god nor a man, but out of what had gone before. A human Jesus was no more necessary than was a human Horus, Dionysus, Mithras, etc. Can we explain the emergence of Christianity without its superstar? Of course we can. For two centuries the Christian movement languished, and thanks to civil war it got its big chance. It was the ultimate product of ancient religious syncretism. But it isn't history, it isn't truth, it's more astounding rubbish from the New Testament.
Well, boys and girls, that'll save you a hell of a lot of the rest of your life sitting around in a musty old church and that kind of stuff and following the Jew book. I saved a hell of a lot out of the rest of my life, I'll tell you that. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. In the meantime, watch out for all this spook in the sky stuff. This time of year, they're going to milk it dry, man. If you want to revere something, revere the real sun, not the phony sun.
Man, listen to a story I will tell. Of a young GI you will remember well. He died in Vietnam on the Mekong Delta land. He had sandals on his feet and a rifle in his hand. I wonder what was his name. I wonder from which town he came. I wonder if his children understand the reason why, or the way he had to fight and the way he had to die. Well, they say that in December 65 was the last time he was ever seen alive. U.S. Army lies that caused him to decide to leave his old top sergeant and fight on the other side. Well, I wonder what was his name. I wonder from which town he came. I wonder if his children understand the reason why, of the way he had to fight and the way he had to die. Was he lonesome for his homeland far away, fighting with his new companions night and day? In the beef and jungle camps they tell about a man sharing hardship with his comrades fighting on the other side. Well, I wonder what was his name. I wonder from which town he came. And I wonder if his children understand the reason why, of the way he had to fight and the way he had to die. It was in the month of April 68. In the desert land, he met a soldier say, fought to his last breath, and he died a hero's death. And he wore the black pajamas of the people in L.A. And his friends are fighting on. And when people win of their heroes, they will sing, and his name will be remembered with the name of Ho Chi Minh. Well, I wonder what was his name. I wonder from which town he came.
Across that song is quite interesting, about a guy in Vietnam who went over on the other side and fought with the Viet Cong. How about that? Racially, it was a bad scene, but sometimes you can understand some of that kind of stuff. Before this battle's over, there's going to have to be a lot of different arrangements made.